intelligence agencies and the bioweapons lobby to keep smallpox fears alive in the public consciousness. Even before the disease was eradicated in 1977, public health regulators had discontinued smallpox vaccinations in the United States. Public health advocates urged the federal bureaucracies and the military to destroy their smallpox stockpile to prevent the disease from escaping and possibly decimating humanity. Ignoring these warnings, the George W. Bush administration purchased even more. During the run-up to the Iraq War, President Bush aimed to inoculate the U.S. population with smallpox vaccines. Skeptics charged that the reckless scheme was PNAC's transparent gimmick for hyping fear of Saddam Hussein's mythological bioweapons program. Dr. Merrill Nass, writing on the history of smallpox vaccine, later reported, "The smallpox vaccine was known to be highly reactogenic. When the vaccine was given to healthcare workers and first responders in 2003, episodes of heart failure, heart attacks, myocarditis, and death quickly mounted. Doctors and nurses learned that they could not sue for damages if injured, and at first there was no federal compensation either. They began refusing to be vaccinated." The Clinton administration continued to stockpile millions of smallpox vaccines, and Congress allotted money for a compensation program, but the maximum award was only $250,000 for a permanent disability or death. After distributing 40 million inoculations, the wave of alarming injuries caused the government to abandon the project's civilian arm. The military continued vaccinating soldiers with the untested, unapproved, deadly vaccine, with catastrophic results. The vaccine caused symptomatic myocarditis in 1 in every 216 soldiers and subclinical myocarditis in 1 in 35 soldiers, according to a 2015 U.S. Army study. Government officials have since recognized vaccines as a probable culprit in the era's epidemic of Gulf War syndrome, which affected vaccinated soldiers both deployed and those vaccinated in preparation for deployment but never deployed. The court observed that absent an informed consent or presidential waiver, the United States cannot demand that members of the armed forces also serve as guinea pigs for experimental drugs. October 4th, anthrax attack. Less than 4 months after the Dark Winter simulation, and 3 weeks after 9/11, a mysterious spate of letters containing fine white anthrax spores arrived by mail at several news media outlets and the Capitol Hill offices of two senators, Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. Those two senators had been the most vocal in condemning the post-9/11 infringements on civil liberties pushed by the PNAC crowd. Administration and press accusations pegging Saddam Hussein as the probable culprit in the anthrax attacks, which killed 5 Americans, fueled Congress's hasty passage of the Patriot Act. As Michael Moore proved, not a single elected member had read the bill, and its jingoistic declaration of war on Iraq. By abolishing traditional privacy protection, the Patriot Act created an entire terror industry, according to a 2021 report by Action Center on Race and Economy. The biggest beneficiaries have been Silicon Valley tech companies, particularly Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, who have partnered with federal intelligence agencies to mine data and profit from the war on terror by at least $44 billion since 2001. The Patriot Act passage, the report says, opened the door for big tech to become first and foremost the brokers of our personal data, selling it to secret agencies and private companies at home and abroad, unleashing the era of the digital economy. Second only to Vice President Dick Cheney, the staunchest war hawk among George W. Bush's Beltway coterie was his Secretary of Defense, former Searle Pharmaceuticals CEO and PNAC chieftain Donald Rumsfeld, the very man who 14 years earlier had given Saddam his anthrax arsenal. While no one has ever proven the origin of the anthrax in those letters, the FBI concluded that the powder had come from a U.S. military lab. Robert Cadlick was first among the large coterie of pharmaceutical companies and military contractors to benefit from the anthrax scare. Immediately after the anthrax letters arrived, Cadlick became a special advisor on biological warfare to then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and his PNAC deputy, Paul Wolfowitz. Three suspects, all linked to the U.S. military. The PNAC cabal was determined to blame the anthrax attack on Saddam Hussein, and Rumsfeld's deputy, Paul Wolfowitz, tasked Cadlick with confirming the presence of bentonite in the anthrax used in the attacks. Experts had advised Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz that bentonite was a fingerprint unique to Iraqi anthrax stocks. Its presence would therefore put the blame on Saddam. Cadlick did not succeed in finding bentonite in any of the anthrax samples that the FBI tested, but repeated media reports claiming otherwise allowed warmongers to drum up jingoistic hysteria against Saddam. By late October 2001, one nationwide poll found that 74% of respondents wanted the United States to take military action against Baghdad, despite a complete lack of evidence connecting Iraq to either 9/11 or the anthrax attacks. Instead of pointing the finger at Saddam, the FBI lab found that the anthrax spores originated from one of three U.S. Army labs, Fort Detrick, a lab at the University of Scranton, or Battelle's West Jefferson facility, owned by an El Hibri business partner. The FBI closed its investigation after its leading suspect, a vaccinologist, Dr. Bruce Ivins, who ran the U.S. Army lab at Fort Detrick, allegedly took his own life. A multitude of critics of the shoddy and haphazard FBI investigation complained that Ivins was the victim of a ham-handed FBI frame. According to the FBI's former lead investigator, Richard Lambert, the FBI team hid a mountain of evidence that would have exonerated Ivins. In 2008, following Ivan's untimely suicide, Department of Justice civil attorneys in Florida, defending a claim by the widow of anthrax victim Robert Stevens, publicly challenged the FBI's assertions that Ivan's had been the culprit and instead pointedly suggested that a private laboratory in Ohio managed by Battelle and linked to the El Hibris could have been involved in the attacks. DOG headquarters quickly had its Florida attorneys rewrite their brief, omitting this claim. An Italian publication, Il Manifesto, reported in its October 2001 issue that the FBI had placed the El Hibris on its suspects list for sending the anthrax spores through the U.S. mail. Cui bono? Since 1995, Cadlick had been frothing about bioterrorism to War College students and urging the creation of a Strategic National Stockpile, SNS, to warehouse vaccines and other countermeasures. In 2004, with Cadlick now working for Secretary Rumsfeld at the Bush White House, Congress passed the Public Health Security and Bioterrorism Preparedness Act, which Cadlick drafted, directing the Secretary of HHS to maintain a strategic national stockpile managed jointly by DHS and HHS. The same week, Congress passed the Project BioShield Act, which Cadlick also helped draft, launching the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, BARDA, a government-operated investment bank that would germinate new technologies for Cadlick's stockpile. With Cadlick's guidance, BARDA would become a federal ATM machine for big pharma, biodefense contractors, and gain-of-function researchers, along with Dr. Fauci's NIAID and the Pentagon's DARPA, BARDA would be the other big league funder for experiments to create pandemic superbugs in Wuhan and elsewhere. Kodlik's statute authorized the purchase of $5 billion of materiel, including vaccines, for the stockpile, creating a gold mine, as we shall see, for Kodlik's friends, the El Hibris. Another conspicuous beneficiary of the stockpile was then Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld and Kodlik's boss, who made a killing during the 2004 fake bird flu pandemic, which Tony Fauci ginned up, with his confederate, an ambitious young British physician and Wellcome Trust researcher, Jeremy Ferrer. 16 years later, as director of Wellcome Trust, Ferrer would play a key role in the 2020 Wuhan cover-up. The Pentagon in 2004 and 2005, in response to Ferrer's concocted contagion, stockpiled 80 million doses of Gilead's flu remedy Tamiflu. Secretary Rumsfeld had served on the board of Gilead from 1988 to 2001 and was its chairman from 1997 until he joined the Bush administration as defense secretary. He retained stock in the pharmaceutical company, which netted him a $5 million profit from the Tamiflu run-up. George Shultz, another PNAC war hawk, also hit the jackpot, cashing in $7 million of Gilead stock during the Tamiflu run-up. The biggest winners, however, were the El Hibris. The anthrax attacks brought them exoneration, salvation, and extravagant windfalls. Bioport's rebirth and reinvention as emergent biosolutions. Anthrax arrived just in time for the El Hibris. Bioport was by then on the ropes. The El Hibris anthrax vaccine facility was facing bankruptcy and the loss of its operating license. Bioport's Pentagon contract expired in August 2001, with a host of outstanding accounting mysteries impeding its renewal. The Pentagon had given Bioport millions to renovate its factory, but much of that money instead financed senior management bonuses and an opulent makeover for the El Hibris executive offices. Millions more simply disappeared, according to journalist Whitney Webb. In 2000, not long after receiving its first Pentagon bailout, Bioport contracted none other than Battelle Memorial Institute to cultivate its anthrax seed stock. Kodlik's boss, Donald Rumsfeld, told aides that his biosecurity priority after the incidents of anthrax sent through the mail was rescuing Bioport. "We're going to try to save it and try to fashion some sort of an arrangement whereby we give one more crack at getting the job done with that outfit. It's the only outfit in this country that has anything underway, and it's not very well underway, as you point out." Gold Rush. In the summer of 2001, 2 months before the 9/11 World Trade Center attacks, the Department of Defense officially launched its drive to revive bioweapons research by sending a report to Congress, authored by Kodlik, pleading that the military system for developing vaccines to protect troops from anthrax, smallpox, and other exotic bioweapons is insufficient and will fail. Beginning with the 9/11 attack, the war on terror triggered a tectonic shift in global security priorities and elephantine ripples in defense spending patterns across the globe as open democracies began shifting to a security state footing. The revival of U.S. government interest in germ warfare opened new opportunities. The U.S. biodefense budget went from $137 million in 1997 to $14.5 billion for 2001 through 2004. Every agency with a colorable claim to a national security function paddled out frantically to barrel the money tsunami. Between 2001 and 2014, the United States spent around $80 billion on biodefense. Since germ weaponry was still illegal, vaccines became a critical euphemism for the revival of the multi-billion-dollar bioweapons industry. Pentagon sources told Science magazine that the military was applying for a sweeping overhaul of how the federal government develops vaccines to protect both the military and civilians. The Pentagon's assault on the vaccine space was both an opportunity and threat to Dr. Fauci and NIAID. U.S. Vice President Cheney and his PNAC Confederates found some convenient loopholes in the Geneva Convention through which they drove a 40-fold expansion in spending in biological weapons research. The Department of Defense had strict systems in place to ensure compliance with the Biological Weapons Convention. Those restrictions limited the Pentagon's freedom to undertake new research programs, particularly those referred to as the leading edge of biodefense. Cheney's response, recalls Professor Richard Ebright, was to transfer this research from the Department of Defense to the National Institutes of Health, specifically to the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. By about 2004, this transfer was complete, and NIAID had been transformed into an arm of the defense sector. This made the NIAID director, Anthony Fauci, a major player in biodefense and germ warfare. Dr. Fauci sharpened his elbows and began maneuvering for a leading role for NIAID in milking the BARDA Homeland Security's cash cows. NIAID's biosecurity budget went from $0 in 2000 to $1.7 billion after the 2001 anthrax letters, much of that for bioweapons vaccines. Within 5 months following the anthrax postal incidents, Dr. Fauci had created two new sub-agencies to capture his share of the cheese: the NIAID Strategic Plan for Biodefense Research and the NIAID Biodefense Research Agenda for CDC Category A agents, which were those microorganisms designated by CDC to be potential pandemic pathogens. To populate the sub-agencies, he assembled a cadre of his loyal deputies and infectious disease principal investigators from the HIV bonanza. Their mission was to brand contagions as pressing terror threats, drum up pandemic panic, and lobby for government support for NIAID's new battery of biodefense vaccinations. Dr. Fauci and the El-Hibris found common cause. Dr. Fauci could run interference for the El-Hibris at FDA, overriding regulatory anxieties about Bioport's laboratory and product safety. The El-Hibris, in turn, provided Dr. Fauci with a ready-made biodefense vaccine and a beachhead into the arcane maze of military contracting. Taking to the airwaves, Dr. Fauci made himself the face of biodefense. In a style now familiar to Americans, Fauci warned the public that postal workers who had handled the letters containing anthrax spores might still be harboring these in their lungs even after taking 2 months of antibiotics, spreading plague with the morning mail. Taking the El-Hibris vaccine prophylactically, Dr. Fauci advised, might help. Dr. Fauci's signature fear-mongering was, of course, his trademark science-free speculation. Nestling the El-Hibris under his protective wing, Dr. Fauci swept aside FDA's safety concerns and publicly praised Bioport's experimental anthrax vaccine, BioThrax. He brushed aside the reservations of critics that the El-Hibris never established BioThrax's safety with some of his prototypical dissembling. Dr. Fauci said, "The vaccine is designed to get the immune system to recognize the proteins, and therefore the bacteria, and destroy both." In a December 2001 PBS interview, Fauci promised to deliver BioThrax, which had failed to pass a single FDA audit during the prior 4 years, at record pace. Fauci explained, "In usual times, that is a process that takes years and years," but he committed that his project for delivering BioThrax is going to be markedly truncated because of the urgency of the situation. PBS observed that because of Bioport's production problems, the Pentagon had dramatically scaled back its plan to vaccinate U.S. forces and there were insufficient anthrax vaccines in the Pentagon's stockpile to conduct the mass civilian inoculation program that had been Dr. Fauci's ultimate aim. But Bioport still possessed the only military contract, and Fuad El-Hibri announced that he was primed to ramp up production. Practically every veteran federal bureaucrat was jockeying to ride the war on terror into the high-stakes winner's circle. The military's medical corps, maneuvering for its share of the overflowing stream of bioterrorism funding, had proposed that each American soldier should receive 75 new vaccines upon enlistment to cover every potential bioweapon. The brass asked President Bush to finance the development of this inoculation fusillade. Not to be outgunned by the military doctors, Dr. Fauci announced in an October 2002 speech that within 10 years, his institute would produce a vaccine, a therapeutic